Hello, Davey.
No, you're not Davey. You're Joey.
Is anyone going to call you Joey?
No, don't do that. I hate that.
I had one teacher in, I think, 7th grade call me Danny, and it drove me nuts. Hated it.
Yeah, Joey and JoJo? No, those are...
JoJo.
No, I hate those.
That's what apparently they call large steak fries in Ohio.
JoJo's?
Yeah.
That's really weird.
Yeah, when I was... We went to... remember I posted the chicken when I was in Ohio, the broasted chicken? I picked up some chicken and JoJo's, which it's... I mean, they're not even really like steak fries. You basically just take a potato and quarter it long ways and...
Oh, so it's like potato wedges from KFC?
Kind of, yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Apparently those are called JoJo's in Ohio.
Okay. Well, that's great.
How's it going?
I'm fine. how are things in Dusty Phoenix after your little storm there?
Big old tree in the front yard broke in half, so I got to cut that up all manly like with an axe, and then I proceeded to strain my back, so you know I can't really do things today without pain. I keep going back to bed and laying on a heating pad trying to become functional again.
Ouch.
Yeah, no. I ruined my back a few years ago, back when I still had a regular job, so I was out for a couple weeks with that. And then, you know, it just continues to plague me for the rest of my life, so that's real fun.
Yay.
Yay! Here's a quick tip, kids. Don't set up a jib by yourself. That's how I hurt myself.
You were on a boat?
No, a camera jib.
Oh. I thought you were talking about the boat jib.
I live like in the desert.
Well, that's why I was very surprised. I don't know if you heard it in my voice.
Yeah, no. No, we had a little, I guess it was like a 15-foot porta-jib or something.
Porta-jib?
Porta-jib, that's the brand. I had the milk crate full of, like weights from Sports Authority or whatever that are counterweights for the camera, and I lifted them wrong by myself because I was the only one there still setting up for the shoot. And, next day I couldn't move, so I had to call an ambulance, which was... really awkward because my back seized up as I was getting out of the shower, so I was I barely had enough time to get any clothes on before I almost blacked out and had to call 911. It was great. We'll cut all that out.
Okay. But moving right along.
Yeah, it was your 4th of July.
It was fine. I had hot dogs with ketchup and mustard, which are sins according to two different kinds of people, so that's good. And
I agree with your methodology.
Yeah, and I had some Dom with that, so it was Dom, ketchup, and mustard, Heinz and French's, of course, because you gotta do it up for America,
right?
So that was the extent of that festive event.
Sounds like one of those upper 1% parties where they decide to like let's you know slum it with the kids and we'll have hot dogs. It'll be fun, just like you know when you were young.
Yeah, it's my ironic side. So, I was going to ask, there was something you had pointed out to me earlier with the acquisition of Shotgun by Autodesk and how they were also going to be forming a new versioning standardization thing or something.
The VFX reference platform, as it's called.
Yes. And yeah, so I was just curious if you felt like explaining to that all to me, because I didn't bother reading it.
Well, right. I read it. I'm looking at it now. Essentially, what I think they're trying to do is they're trying to determine what versions of scripting languages and file formats should be used for development of software platforms during a given year. So for 2014, they suggest using Python 2.7.3, OpenEXR 2.0.1, OpenColor.io 1.0.7, and Alembic 1.5x, basically because if you use all of these when building your software platform, it will help things be more interchangeable, even though building your platform on top of these doesn't necessarily mean that you're going to be interchangeable.
No, it just means that you're more likely to work with Autodesk, because I think those are all the default versions that they use in their software.
Well, you know, that article said... the VES was working with Autodesk and other software manufacturers, and you know, they didn't
list any others, but that's fine. I guess the idea being that if you have in-house scripting or custom tools that you're building to make your pipeline interface better, that those tools will then be usable on other platforms. That doesn't make any sense to me, because obviously if you have a pipeline tool that's built off the Nuke Python API, it's not going to be very useful in any Autodesk products.
No. So, again, I'm not really sure I follow any of this stuff. I mean, it has more to do with, like, pipeline development for, like, the scripting stuff that you might be doing outside of your pipeline, what default version of Python that is, that you're writing things that will automatically generate files in multiple environments. But that's so far above and beyond anything that I do that I couldn't really muster any sort of concrete opinion about that.
All right, well, let me read just this beginning part, so maybe this will clarify who exactly this is for. It says, the VFX reference platform is a set of tool and library versions to be used as a common target platform for building software for the VFX industry. I guess that's for in-house stuff as well as major software, but, I mean, making a standardization for Python isn't really going to be major motivation for a software vendor to version their internal API to match. I mean,
no, it has very little to do with anything, really, because you're just not very likely to run into any problems from Python versioning in what you're writing inside of like Nuke or inside of Maya.
Yeah.
And I mean, unless you're like talking Python 2.7 versus Python 3 or something like that, but
right.
Most places that I've been to have 2.7 environments set up of some variety, either 3 or 5 or 8.
The next line that it says is, its purpose is to minimize incompatibilities between different software packages, ease the support burden for Linux-based pipelines, and encourage further adoption of Linux by software vendors. Is this just a Linux thing? Or how would this be more relevant to Linux than anything else, just because most of these tools are Linux-based?
No, well, it doesn't seem to... I wouldn't say that probably has nothing to do with anything, because whether or not you're on... There are incompatibilities between different Linux distributions and different package management things and stuff, and that's why most facilities and stuff like that, they standardize on, like, Red Hat Enterprise Linux or some derivation of that.
Right, you build your workstation up as needed for your particular project, but I mean, is any studio really going to install OpenSubdiv 2.3.3 on their Linux workstation this year because of a reference platform, as opposed to whatever they think they need based on the given project? I mean, if you have to, increase your particle simulation tools this year to, get a new feature in place, are they really going to care about what the reference platform says?
I have no idea.
Yeah, and I don't know how this is useful. I mean, a lot of people seemed really excited that there's a reference platform, but...
No, but it's basically just like, here's what Autodesk is using. Make sure you're using what Autodesk is using.
But, like, I mean, how many of these things are exposed in Autodesk? Do you use any Autodesk products? You used Maya for a while, didn't you?
Yeah, but, I mean, that's why I said it has more to do with the people setting up all of the things that happen externally than anything an artist would touch. Unless you are somehow some sort of hybrid artist / pipeline position, which can happen at a smaller place, I guess. But I generally don't think it's going to have any impact for anybody who considers themselves to be an artist over a pipeline person. And for pipeline people, I'm going to guess that they're largely going to ignore any of this stuff, because it doesn't really sound like it's that consequential or that helpful compared to how people are currently doing things. But that might be my naivete as an artist speaking there.
I mean, a lot of these things are new enough that they're not really even rolled into the vast majority of software products as far as I'm aware. I mean, OpenEHR 2.0 just got put into Nuke, in 2 versions ago. OpenColor.io, OpenSubdiv, Alembic's been around for a while,
Well, not a while, but...
I mean, compared to some of these other things, at least the versions that they're talking about. Alembic 1.5 was only in Nuke 8, I thought.
But 2.7.3 of Python is super old.
Right.
I mean, that's not current. And there's no legitimate reason I can think of off the top of my head why it would even matter if you're using 273 or 278 or 275. Because they're all like little bug fixy versions of the 27 branch. But whatever. Again, there might be some consequence that I'm unaware of. So I'm hesitant to like come down definitively on it. I thought that when you had initially said that this was going to be versioning stuff, that it was going to be about fixing the mess of versioning files, not the mess of what software versions you're using for things. And also, this platform does nothing for tracking versions used to produce things, which is another problem that people should actually record information for.
Yeah, it's... Yeah, I guess you're right. There's really not much more than saying, here's the different open source tools that we're using in our software platform this year, and here's the ones we plan on using next year, and it would all be fun if you guys used the same things for some reason.
Yeah, I don't know. Like I said, I can't see any consequence, and I would have much rather they come out with some definitive stance on recording software versions used for things into file headers or something, so that when you went back and needed to reproduce some old thing, that you could be like, oh, well, I need to set these environment variables or something like that. Like, that nobody tracks that in the third party world. I mean,
we've talked about this before. The that fun trick where you can stick an entire Nuke script in a DPX header. Didn't we talk about that?
I don't think we mentioned that, no.
Well, I mean, you know, as I'm sure you're aware, and I'm sure people who will listen to this are aware, you can basically copy and paste a Nuke script into a text editor, and it's all, you know, Python, so it's human readable, and it can be copy and pasted back into Nuke as nodes. But you can copy all that data and paste it into a modify metadata node right before your DPX write. So you can basically write out a frame sequence that has your comp file built into it, which, I mean... You can kind of, you at that point can, you know, read the comp back out and reverse engineer the script itself. But I don't know if that keeps things like version numbers. At very minimum, you know, Nuke itself would recognize what those nodes were and where they came from. Even if there was a new version of the node, it would, you know, it warns you like it does. But, that's not a thing that they encourage, I don't think.
No, I wouldn't want to do that because then, you know, there are some Nuke scripts that can be quite large. Mm-hmm. Adding that onto every single image file for every frame is an incredible amount of overhead. I mean, storing metadata is fine. Like, this is the file path that was used. This is the path to the Nuke library that was used. This is the path to, you know, these plugins that were used. That kind of recording, I think, is great. And that's low capacity kind of stuff. But, you know, most of the time people are writing out things like the side project I'm helping out with, you know, it's such a small scale that it's just like, well, why record that information? Like, there's the amount of effort you'd need to put into setting up things to write that metadata is just kind of pointless. It would have been nice if that was just built in. Yeah. There's no standard way that people store, you know, version information, what gizmos were used, because gizmos are a total mess sometimes, depending on the context. Because they're not really in the file, and so, you know, compared to other compositing packages or other software packages, whenever you have, like, some sort of a macro thing, that what it'll do is, like, actively import that chunk of script into your scene, whereas with gizmos, it's sort of like, let me just call that stuff, and so hopefully that thing doesn't really change, and, like, you don't have different knobs, because then it'll freak out, because you set something on a knob that doesn't exist anymore, or now you have a new knob that didn't have a setting, but is supposed to have some other default thing, so then you can have some undesirable gizmo stuff that can happen. But, whatever. I don't think it has grossly impacted anyone before. It would just be nice if one of these days somebody just smoothed it out.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, the gizmo problem is why I've become fond of tool sets lately, which is, you know, it's basically just referencing a separate Nuke script. It's not even trying to package it up into a gizmo or a group form. It's just half of a Nuke script in another place that it references. It's pretty similar to the precom node, basically. But yeah, I mean,
forgetting a gizmo or where it's placed, or, you know, trying to keep them. I try and keep most things I can in Dropbox or whatever, so they're all linked with the same path, but yeah, it's never really terribly useful. But I got a new version of that color correction plugin that ruined my script last time, so, I mean, you know, playing with that now. Hasn't vaporized any scripts lately.
Dan?
Yes?
What did I say about that?
I'm just testing it. I'm not using it in production.
Okay, good. No, but I just going back for a brief second, one of the sanest implementations I've ever seen, and I can talk about this because it's literally in the Foundry's very publicly readable manual, so it's not an NDA thing, is you can go read up on live groups in Katana, and what that is it saves a snippet of what that group of nodes is supposed to do. So that's in the file, but it also has a path to what it should retrieve when you open the script, and you can also set versions on it or path stuff or whatever you want to do. And so then that way you can keep it in the same spot in your script, you can change what it's supposed to be pointing to, or you can open it up and it'll have what it's supposed to be in case the other thing has gone missing.
You mean it'll have links to the assets that it's trying to import to assemble the scene?
No. Well, it could if that was what was in it. But like a gizmo or a toolset.
Oh, okay.
It can, with a live group, it's basically saying, okay, this is your lump of whatever scene you want, and it'll just come in to your scene. It will be stored inside of the file in case it can't read from disk. But it will prefer to read from disk. So if you make any change out there, it will update inside of your scene.
Well, doesn't that have the same gigantic file size problem that you were talking about with embedding a script inside of a sequence?
Oh, no, but this isn't embedding it inside of your image. This is just inside of your working Katana scene.
Right, but isn't the Katana scene going to be substantially larger at that point then?
No, no. When I was talking about the downside of putting the Nuke script inside of every image is that you'd have it inside of every image, so then cumulatively you don't need that.
Right.
Whereas with the Katana scene, you only have one Katana scene. Like, you don't write out a Katana scene for every image.
Yeah, fair enough. I think I'm slowly starting to understand Katana. It looks baffling even to me.
No, I like it. And I'm biased because I used it, but again, all the publicly available information on it is great. So I recommend looking at it because it has a lot of really cool ideas.
I was just watching some of the videos on the Foundry site about Katana for some reason the other day, and a lot of Watchmen footage in that little demo video they got there.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh, speaking of movies. Which horrible thing would you like to discuss first? Do you want to talk about the one that you like or the one that we both don't like? Which mood are you in?
So I watched World War Z because it's on Netflix now. I mean, it's been there for what, like a couple weeks, and I had it in my little queue to watch, and it came and went with I didn't really hear much about it when it was in theaters, did you?
I heard a lot about it because it was the highest grossing zombie movie ever.
Oh, was it? Mm-hmm. I saw that it made something like $500 million.
That's a lot, Dan.
Yes, it is.
I don't know how to break it to you, but that's a lot.
No, I just thought it was funny that after all the production was, the sequel, I think, you know, they originally intended for at least one, maybe two sequels, were shelved. And then once it made $500 million, like, well, we'll put at least one sequel back on the production schedule and see how that goes.
Yeah, hopefully without Mark Foster directing it.
Yeah, no, I don't believe he is. I don't think any of the same people are on board. Well, I mean, who knows about actors, obviously, Brad Pitt. But same different director, different writer, if I read correctly.
Well, they've had plenty of different writers only on that one movie.
It was four, I think it was.
I lost track. I was reading the Wikipedia article on it after you had after you brought up the fact that I didn't really know how many times the end of it was rewritten. I went back and I was looking at it. I was like, oh, J. Michael Straczynski did the first pass on it. I like him. And then I was reading all the subsequent things. I was like, wait, what?
Yeah, movie that was in development for, what, like 8 years or something? And then my favorite part in the Wikipedia article is how they talk about they were getting ready to go shoot the third act, and they flew all of their guns and props to Budapest and then forgot to get clearance to bring guns into Budapest, and then it all got raided by the police and taken. But they couldn't prosecute anyone because there was nobody's name on the shipping manifest, so they basically just said, well, we don't know who to throw in jail, so just go away.
Well, yeah, my favorite part was that they were not supposed to be functional, but they were.
Yeah.
So it was like, okay, good job smuggling automatic weapons into Budapest, guys.
Yeah, well, I mean, who knows what that actually means, because most of those weapons do actually function. There's just there's no hole in the barrel. They just fire blank rounds that are, just very loud and stupid. But yeah, they're 5 hours worth of work away from being a functioning weapon, but they don't usually use real guns.
Yeah. Okay, well, let's start at the beginning and then unwind from there. I have to say, the thing that I noticed first when I watched it is that opening scene of the kids going into the bedroom, which is
Dawn of the Dead starts?
Yeah, it was exactly what I thought of as soon as I saw that. I was like, I'm pretty sure that was either intentional or somebody mentioned it to him, and they're like, oh, that's fine, and then left it.
Again, this goes back to, like, pitch meeting 101. It's like, all right, the day of the zombie infection starts. Where do we start? Let's start at the beginning of the day. The guy wakes up, and how is it going to affect his day? And it's like, you don't have to start there. I mean, I thought they did a decent job of, throwing the family into the chaotic mess when they were driving around in the car, and just how they reacted to it was sort of genuine, I guess. But the waking up scene was completely unnecessary.
Okay, I have no problem with their reaction, but I have a problem with the reaction of the entire world, because they're listening to the radio and they're talking about, like, oh, there's like little rabies things happening or something. It escalates really quickly from that little radio conversation to like explosions and police activity and military activity. Like, there's so much that happens right there in quote unquote Philadelphia that it's really strange that it just sort of propelled from 0 to 100 million miles per hour. All of a sudden.
Yeah, I think that may have been mostly intentional. They were talking about how fast the infection spreads. He did that goofy thing where you couldn't really tell that it was his internal monologue, where he was counting off the 12 seconds that it took for that one guy to turn and become a zombie in the very first one.
Yeah, I mean, but at the same time, the fact that the police and military show up so fast.
Oh, yeah, well.
Yeah, it was like, well, they should have, the stage that people should have been at on public radio should have been a little closer to the police and military stage, not the, oh, maybe there's some rabies things or something. I thought that was a little strange. I mean, of course, it's there to, propel you into it as fast as possible, and the outbreak does seem to spread very quickly from this 12-second incubation period, which is bizarrely fast. But that's one of those things where it's like, okay, I will compartmentalize that into the zombie rule book. I'll say this virus operates, in 12 seconds. Fine. Mm-hmm. I'll put it over there. That is zombie rule number one here. Of course, we quickly see that it has to do with being bitten and not with ingesting their blood.
Yeah.
Which is also, I don't know what to make of that. So we'll put that as zombie rule number two.
That was one clever moment where he was self-aware enough to go stand right on the ledge there, just in case that the ingesting the blood was a way to get infected as well. But that weird sort of like silence, like Tom Hanks in Saving Private Ryan moment he has like three times throughout the film, where he's just pausing and staring at somebody off in the distance. Like, how did not in one of those moments he get blindsided by somebody, whether a zombie or just somebody running by? He's just standing there in the middle of the chaos, just watching one particular person who is either turning into a zombie or not turning into a zombie. It was very strange.
Mm-hmm. Oh, well, I did blow past something, though. We get introduced, sort of, to the fact that he used to work for the UN, and that he is apparently important enough that they are willing to send people out to potentially die to retrieve him, which
Matthew Fox's quick little cameo.
Yeah, which is strange.
And yeah, so I guess he was supposed to have a larger role, but yeah, didn't have time.
But yeah, well, there's a lot of things that got cut from this movie. And so they, they go over to the ship. Oh, wait, I'm sorry. I also was skip past a really other great part, which is that we see humanity raiding that convenience store, drugstore,
yeah,
little marketplace thing. I thought that was very well put together, because it showed everything disintegrating, the police officer not caring about anything happening, just grabbing stuff for himself.
Uh-huh.
That showed the disorganization and society completely breaking down. Which,
but, I mean, the grocery store scene is kind of a canonical zombie movie scene, right? I mean, is there any other way that scene can go?
No, but I'm glad that it was done well enough. That was competent. I didn't see any major flaw with it. There are, of course... So, skipping back ahead, they leave on their chopper, and then we get the strange UI presentation of, we've had time to make this person progress bar that gets infected. And
the, like, one that's moving so quickly that it would be over in 10 seconds.
Yeah, it was so strange. I was watching that. I was just like, so how did they have time to, like, fly in the graphic designers to put together the zombie... like progress bar thing, like this.
Well, I think they generally have a giant red bar that goes from zero to all of people on Earth, talking about, you know, that is there for the strict purpose of showing how many people have died based on any given moment. And you know, somebody just did the calculation and recompiled the JSON or something, and it just ran all the way up to the top. Oh god. But no, we did miss the one his ingenuity, you know, being a clever UN investigator, he tapes a magazine to his forearm so they don't bite him. Because apparently the only place the zombies attack is your left forearm.
Well, it was... I had less of a problem with that than
well, but he does some it, like, of his three other times.
Tactics. Yeah.
They tape magazines around their ankles at one point, and it's just like, all right, ankles and wrists, you're protected. It's like, all right, you've got a neck and a face, but sure, whatever.
Well, I think it's mostly because... they could be potentially using that part of their body to push somebody off of them, but that's not really well communicated, and certainly just putting it on one arm seems a little strange. But the it just doesn't add up. Like, once they start going into how they're going to diagnose this situation, and so they're gonna have him fly to South Korea to get information and do nothing? Like,
because where they got that communique about zombies or whatever. But, like, I mean, take a step back to when they land on the aircraft carrier or whatever. They're finally safe. He's finally happy. His friend got him out of there or whatever. But it comes with the condition that he has to go find this stuff. And he said, you know, he does his incredibly obvious refusal of the call, what, like five times. He just stands there going, nope, staying with my family, nope. And then they get to the part where, you know, if you don't do this, we have to kick you off, which, spoiler alert, happens anyway. And he's so worried that they get about them getting kicked off of the aircraft carrier that he goes and puts his life at risk. But when they got kicked off the aircraft carrier, they were fine. They went to, what was it?
Nova Scotia,
and they were fine. Like, he should have just said, fine, we won't stay on the ship, kick us off. I'm going to stay with my family and ride this thing out. They would have been fine.
No, but you had no way of knowing that. And but, also, if he hadn't done the ridiculous things that he goes on to do in the movie and come up with the solution, then they might not be safe forever at that place. Because they wouldn't have the ridiculous plot device to protect themselves.
Perhaps, but, I mean, for somebody who was so concerned with protecting and staying with his family, all he had to do was go, you're going to kick us off the boat, where are you going to send us? Oh, we've got this military complex in Nova Scotia, cool, I'll go there. And then, you know, maybe figure it out from there. You don't have to go right into, fine, I'll fly to South Korea right now and my family can stay here.
Yeah, well, I don't know. I didn't think that was as big of a deal, because it was obviously going to be better for them if they were on the aircraft carrier. That was going to be a more protected situation than if they were on the mainland.
Yeah, I mean, maybe I was looking for him to admit a little bit that he kind of misses being in the game or something, but, you know, he seemed fully committed to not leaving his family's side, which, you know, is probably what a sane person would do, but... Anyway, so he ends up in South Korea. There's nothing there. There's some weird military guys and a bunch of people that were burned to death, and they ride bicycles around.
It doesn't... that whole thing didn't make any sense. I didn't understand it, because they land in an airfield when it's dark and raining,
Mm-hmm.
They open up the giant back door, which is completely indefensible.
That's the only way to get off a military plane, right? They don't have doors on the sides.
There's no other way out. You just have to open the giant door. And so that was stupid. And then they only have a couple of guys with them. Like, I thought for sure they were going to actually meet up with a crew somewhere and take a helicopter in.
Didn't they even mention that as like aircraft carrier? They mentioned that as like a positive before he took off. He's like, "Don't worry, we'll just send you and like a small crew of Navy SEALs. It'll be fine." It's like, set the giant crew of Navy SEALs. What are you talking about?
Yeah, they didn't send enough people. That was ridiculous. Because they lose, you know, so many people. Like, and the doctor guy,
who they claim is their best hope of solving this thing.
Yeah, he trips and kills himself.
which they stole from Out of Sight, which is fine, but, you know, just mm-hmm. stupid people with guns.
Yeah. So that was anticlimactic. And they somehow get... Somehow the base commander knows to go get them, but not to protect the airstrip ahead of time. So that's strange. And then they go there and they meet up with him and they talk to the strange toothless guy. And then they take those bikes, like you said, back in the rain to refuel the ship, which they do really fast, I have to say. Like, that seemed really fast. And yet they had no plans for, like, disengaging the fuel. They had to send that guy back out to do it.
Right, and then that guy basically says, this better be worth it or whatever, because he has to go back out in the zombie land. But doesn't he get away fine? Or, like, we just never see him again?
We never see him again. I'm assuming that he got eaten by one of the ones that was stuck in the wire fence. But that was all ridiculous. And so then they're off from there to Israel. Mm-hmm. Of course, it's so suspicious that they protected themselves, and they kind of sort of imply that maybe they had an advantage over everybody else, that nobody else was paying attention to this. And we come to meet this ridiculous Mossad agent who invites him up, tells him the plan, but then in the middle of the plan, they apparently stop talking completely, go to another vehicle, and then resume their conversation exactly where they left off.
Yeah, just cut to 10 minutes later, and they're word for word exactly where they were.
Yeah, I didn't understand that. And they do that another time, right in that same conversation, when they cut from them being in the vehicle to them being inside the building at the wall. They don't lose the in-between parts of their conversations. They literally just stop and resume their conversations whenever they move these locations.
Right. Well, never mind that. Like, where are they going? He's there to have a conversation. Why are they driving around and going places? Just to show him the sights of their giant wall?
Yeah,
who cares? It's a wall. He flew over it. He could see it.
Well, but he wants to show him the gate for processing people coming in. Right. And one of the good things is that they can immediately tell whether or not someone has been infected. It's not like other zombie outbreak movies where the gestation period could run hours or days.
No, but like at one point I saw somebody flashing like a red light into people's eyes to see if they were infected or not. It's like, what is that going to do if the answer is yes? They're just going to bite your hand right there.
Well, yeah, that was back in South Korea. That didn't seem to make any sense to me either. Because if you have a 12-second gestation period for this virus, then like they're before you've opened the door, if they were bitten then by the time they've passed through the door threshold, they've already been converted.
Right. And, so, but in South Korea, they said that one guy took, you know, 10 minutes to turn. So apparently it's not just 12 seconds, or the disease is changing or growing or something or whatever. They keep hinting back at this, you know, it being a disease or not a disease, like a virus or something that's growing and learning or something. And that's eventually how they defeated or whatever. But their tactics for auditing people, like a bus full of people comes through the wall in Jerusalem and there's a guy with one of those little mirror things looking under the bus. It's like, why didn't you do that outside? What is that going to do? And they have enough foresight to use a mirror to look under a bus to see if there are any zombies clinging to the bottom, but apparently that doesn't apply to airplanes.
Yeah, I don't know. It doesn't make any sense, because then they start the whole thing of like sound enticing them to turn into the zombie flood that washes over the wall, which is ludicrous, and it is by far one of the worst things that I've seen in that movie. I I feel very bad for saying something so mean about the visual effects of this film, but the zombies just look sort of like a beige wave of lumpy clay people that sort of wash over the side of the thing. Like, the dynamics of them were very bendy. Yeah, the dynamics of them, because they're so bendy and so fast-moving, that they become almost a fluid, which is very... I have a hard time processing that into something that looks realistic.
Yeah, I mean, for something on that scale, would you imagine they used a particle simulation for that?
Maybe Massive. They seem to at least make contact with one another, but I am sure that if you looked at it, I bet they have, like, hands through torsos and stuff. That they just touch up the most offensive ones would be my guess. But yeah, it was one of the least effective things that I saw in the movie, and also incited by one of the most ridiculous things, the sound, apparently. Drives them crazy.
Well, I mean, aside from, you know, the way they acted as a horde, and I'm sure this was the directorial mandate, but the way they dive horizontally and, like, were tackling people into cars, I mean, they would leave their feet at like 50 miles an hour and they would suddenly be horizontal and smashing people into walls, and it's like there's no way that's possible. So I mean, no matter how they would have tried to animate the bending or the movement of the zombies at that point, there's no way it was believable. It looked, I mean, you can watch footage of animals in the Serengeti tackling other animals, and there's no way it doesn't look that brutal or fast or violent. And I guess maybe they wanted to really amp it up for cinema or whatever, but it just looked kind of ridiculous at times, especially when they would do the close-ups of like one person tackling another person.
Yeah, well, that's mainly because they don't have any. It doesn't have gravity. Like, it doesn't feel like there was a force that was overcome in order to move that distance. You know, which is sort of an animation thing. Like, you know, if you're gonna jump, like, that character is gonna like crouch down and then shoot back up. Like, that's how they're gonna jump. But if they just sort of like launch from a perfect standing position, then they flew. They didn't jump.
Yeah, they just went from zero to turning into like General Bison from Street Fighter, just plowing through people.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway.
So I found that really hard to believe. And you know, sure enough, they infect so quickly that they're able to overcome all the defenses. Everything disintegrates really fast, which is fine, except Brad Pitt has enough time to pause and turn and stare at this poor kid who obviously has an illness because his head is bald, and that is the only way in film to communicate that someone is ill.
I couldn't tell. Is that what it was? His head was bald?
Yeah, he had a shaved head, which is, you know, to imply that he had some sort of a cancer or something that was requiring him to be treated. That was immediately the first time I saw that. I knew that was what the shorthand was, that he was sick.
I got the shorthand when they showed the old man and then they showed the kid, and it's like, well, okay, the frail old man has to be something sick as well. So
yeah,
I inferred through just association.
Yeah, exactly. And but just in case you miss it, they go back and they have a montage about it later,
right?
So that's ludicrous. And why this one soldier is so devoted to getting Brad Pitt out makes no sense to me, because obviously the world has just ended inside of Jerusalem. Like, get the hell out of the city.
Well, I mean, he saves her life by, well, kind
well,
of.
Well, but he does, yeah. But he doesn't save her life immediately. That doesn't happen like right away. Also, it doesn't make any sense. If something spreads so fast in 12 seconds that you turn into a zombie, then how is the 3 seconds that he waited before he chopped off her hand going to save her from anything? Like, wouldn't that just be in her bloodstream? Like, there, you know, it doesn't make any sense. Like, if you're gonna have something move that quickly, then you can't say, oh well, nothing happens until the 12 second mark. That's stupid.
Especially somebody who's in the midst of battle, how fast is your heart gonna be pumping? But again, we're splitting hairs here. They tried to do like a bullet time kind of thing with his slow thought process where he was analyzing everything, but it was just kind of dumb. I mean, the bigger thing here is, I mean, we've got these repetitive tropes, but like, what has happened in the movie? There was a zombie outbreak. They went to a building. They went to an aircraft carrier. They went to South Korea. Like, he hasn't done anything. Nothing really happens in this movie. He rides a bike. He crashes in an airplane. But he doesn't, like, nothing happens. They don't really do anything until the very end. And at that, he does very little. I mean, I think when I was reading that, they said this could originally be a trilogy because, if I recall, this movie diverges from what actually happens in the book and does not use the book's ending to save for another time, I guess. But the whole thing is basically like a prolonged first act. There is no middle or end to this thing. Nothing really happens. It's all information gathering, and then they start to find a way to coexist. They don't really... I mean, am I wrong? I mean, does it feel like anything happens in this movie, or is it just a prolonged first act?
It feels like it's three prolonged first act. I'm sorry, four. Because you have basically outbreak in Philadelphia. Then you have outbreak in... Well, you have the navigating South Korea, where an outbreak has happened and is ongoing. Then you have Israel, where an outbreak happens. And then you have the plane, where an outbreak happens. And then you have your fifth part, which is the end, quote-unquote, which is when they get to Cardiff, to the WHO headquarters, which they managed to do without any sort of guidance, really, which is miraculous.
The WHO?
Yeah. Well, or I mean,
did you call it WHO as a pun because of the employee that works there?
No, well, it's called a WHO organ. I mean, nobody says WHO, but
okay.
But I mean, you could say WHO.
I do.
It's your prerogative. You can also say GUI if you'd like.
I don't.
But it's all a bunch of outbreaks that keep happening, and it's repetitive because they're almost exactly identical, except with like the small realizations that come along with each one. But each of those small realizations is really kind of dumb, because we as the audience figure out that it is terminal illness, apparently, which is another zombie rule, which makes no sense, because by the time they get to the WHO headquarters and they've come to this conclusion, and he's trying to convince the scientist, and it's like, oh, well, yeah, that makes sense, because predators can detect if someone's sick. And it's like, well, predators can do that because they have really enhanced olfactory senses, and, you know, they're very specialized to that task. Like, a human cannot tell that another human is ill.
Well, apparently just by looking at them. The zombie illness went through about 3 billion years of evolution in a couple days or a couple hours or whatever it is to allow them to have that sort of sixth sense of what disease is infecting you.
But it also doesn't make any sense, because
no, it doesn't make any sense.
Why would it matter if it's infected tissue or not? Because obviously they don't care that they're decaying. Like, the zombies themselves are decaying, so they themselves are terminally ill. Like, why would it matter?
It's this theme that they've tried to instill, where they say that, you know, the zombie infection is like this larger connected thing that's trying to take over because it's Mother Nature or whatever it is. But I mean, at this point, it's no longer a zombie movie. It's just, you know, any infection movie or disease, whatever, outbreak movie. That it doesn't even have to do with zombies. It's just a spreading disease, apparently.
No, but it's really the stupid zombie rules that they glue onto it that make it a zombie movie, that make it annoying and dumb. Like, if this had been some military bioengineered weapon, and if it had like some political message or something to it, like, right, there's nothing. There's literally nothing. Like, this
they
is
basically
just like
combined a zombie movie with oh god, what was that one a couple years ago with Matt Damon?
Contagion. 2001.
That's the one. Yeah.
Sorry, 2011.
They've essentially combined a zombie film with Contagion and just sort of picked and choose which parts of which movie they want to use at any given time.
Mm-hmm.
Contagion was a great movie, by the way. I mean, for something like that.
I haven't seen it. I liked Outbreak.
Yeah, Outbreak was good.
To holler back to the 90s. But the... yeah, I mean, it's just silly at this point, because when I went back to read the Wikipedia article, because I was like, maybe, you know, let me give the original writer of World War Z some credit and go read what at least the summary of what this was supposed to be. And so I'm reading what that book was supposed to be about, and I can't help but notice that it is totally, completely, 100% different from the movie, even down to the rules of the zombies and how the zombies function. Like, they went with a completely different route. Like, in the book, they're slow, and they are uncoordinated, and that it's... the military's more effective at disposing of them, and it's more about, like, a sort of a grim series of journals about what's gone on, like, the report on the ground of how things are progressing. And they didn't do anything like that in the film. And they didn't obey any of the zombie rules in the film. It seemed like they just really wanted to make the fast zombie movies of the, you know, 2000s, the late 2000s.
And this is as good a place as any to turn this conversation into what I wanted to talk about in general, is the problem with zombie movies, TV shows, whatever, in general, is that the zombies are the premise that starts the whole thing, but after, you know, the first 10 minutes, the zombies no longer matter. It doesn't matter if they're zombies or monsters or whatever. What you're watching is humanity having been reduced to, what, like 0.1% of the total population by whatever devastating force they have chose. And then it's just the way those people live with each other. You know, the raiding places for resources, the, you know, the things people are willing to do to survive. At that point, it just becomes, you know, War of the Worlds, or it becomes Contagion, or it becomes anything where people are struggling to survive. And at that point, the zombies are really just background noise. And that's where I lose interest, because the zombies are there because, you know, it adds a threat, but, you know, it's really no different than, like, This Is the End, the Seth Rogen movie, because there's monsters outside, they got to stay inside, and the movie is about how those characters survive and what they have to do. But it doesn't matter. The zombies don't matter anymore. And this happens in every zombie movie. Whatever the circumstances are, it becomes about survival of X. It doesn't matter what the zombies are, how fast they move, how slow they move, what they've done. There's an outbreak, or, you know, whether it's a disease, or whether you have to be bitten, or whatever the rules are. It doesn't matter, because at that point, it's just about people. And unless you can come up with something about, you know, the way people will live in sort of a post-apocalyptic type environment, it's just, you know, people sitting around and waiting to die.
Yeah, well, and see, I'm going to say something really controversial here, in that I actually like Zack Snyder's Dawn of the Dead remake from several years ago. And I know that's controversial, because a lot of people would say that George A. Romero stuff is superior.
No, I'm with you. I liked it.
Yeah, in terms of the message that it was sending, whereas Zack Snyder's doesn't really have a message, but it is a survival movie. And that the zombie rules are consistent, that it becomes more about the human politics inside of the shopping mall, that whether or not they're just going to try and stay inside the shopping mall forever, or whether or not they're going to try to do something and get to safety, like, that is the only struggle there. That the zombies outside might as well be killer bees. Like, that's not, just like you're saying, like, that the struggle is more about what humans do. And in this movie, in World War Z, there's not really a struggle about what the humans are doing. The humans, wherever Brad goes, are very cooperative.
They're usually holed up and they're fine, you know, except in the instances like the airplane where somebody forgot to check the bottom area, and then the lady pushes the elevator button and suddenly they're screwed. But, like, yeah, for the most part, if you can avoid the human tendencies to, like, want to go outside, or the weakness of, like, oh, this person's not really infected, let's bring them in. Like, if you can avoid that, you're fine. That's it. You're done. You just sit there and you have a boring life until you die.
Yeah, but at least in something like Dawn of the Dead remake by Zack Snyder, like, you have the struggle of, what is the ethical situation? Do you take these people in? They could be infected. They could not be infected. Are you going to be their saviors? Are they going to be the ruination of you? Like, but none of that stuff happens in this film. Like,
yeah, in Dawn of the Dead, they got kind of caught off guard, and they ended up in a mall. They didn't end up on an aircraft carrier or in a military sanctioned hideaway in Nova Scotia or anything. They were, you know, running for their lives, and they ended up in a mall with a couple people who actually were infected, but, you know, it was hidden from them. And, you know, that was a plausible scenario where the ethical decisions were in question and there were difficult things that had to be done. But, you know, in this one, they've still got a substantial military force that they're directly tied to and they're hanging out with most of the time. Just stay there. Just, like, pick one of the military bases that's fine for now and stay there and see how that goes. Like, what the entire hope rests on, A, this doctor who shoots himself in the head immediately, and then Brad Pitt somehow.
Well, but then also the stupid thing is, once they figure out what the cure to this is, which is not a cure, it's the camouflage of how they will keep their forces unseen from the zombies and then wipe out all the zombies by sending out sick troops. Like,
and then never mind that. Like, when they're talking about that at the end, they talk about how, you know, this camouflage helped them win. They show one of the scenarios where they were winning, where they just they blared something through the loudspeaker at a football stadium and then blew it up. Like, what part of the camouflage did you need for that?
None. Like, it made no difference. And then they showed, like, one of the scenes of whatever it was, the 20 minutes of Moscow stuff that got cut out from the film, according to Wikipedia. They had, like, one of those in there. And they had the whole thing of, like, burned corpses and, like, one struggling guy and a bulldozer running it over. Like, so eventually they just sort of burn down everything to the point where things will be okay-ish again. But it doesn't seem like it had... It doesn't seem like there's anything that they wind up doing at the end that isn't something they could have done earlier. I don't know. It just doesn't strike me as sane.
Maybe they needed just a little more time to basically say, you know, we're freaked out and we're trying to figure out what our course of action is, and they would have arrived at the same course of action no matter what, which at that point it doesn't really necessarily make it a movie about Brad Pitt, and Brad Pitt's kind of unnecessary because they're going to do what they're going to do regardless. But, you know, if all it takes is one guy who's able to keep his calm long enough in a war zone to stare at the zombies and how they're behaving, it doesn't seem like it would have been that difficult to come up with a plan regardless, because all he really did was take a moment to study his enemy, which is what anyone would do in any sort of major military situation like that. So, you know, he's not crucial to the story. The things he does are not crucial to the story. And, you know, as I mentioned, I don't think the zombies themselves were necessarily crucial to the story. It's about people in survival. So not much really happens in this movie for me at all. It's just an hour and 50-something minutes of explosions and gunfire and running and things like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I didn't care for it. So should we talk about the thing that you like?
I mean, it suffers from the same problems, but yeah. I mean, Shaun of the Dead is an instance where the movie is entertaining, regardless of the fact that, again, it's not a movie about zombies as much as it is about survival, but, you know, they spend time with characters that you actually like, and they stay together, even though that makes it more difficult on them, and, you know, you come to care more about the characters. Maybe if Brad Pitt would have stayed with his family, we would have liked them enough to want to, like, care about them and make sure that they're okay, rather than him just ditching them and running away.
Yeah, well, it's hard to draw a parallel here, because I think that even in terms of directing, regardless of whatever the story is, I think Edgar Wright's movie is far and above better executed.
Well, it's coherent is what it is.
Yeah, well, but not just coherent, but artfully shot. Like the snappy edits, like everything is just put together in such a careful way. Things that you're supposed to pay attention to off camera, things that are put together to repeat so that you see the difference from the day before the outbreak and the day after the outbreak. You know, you see the how things are unfolding around in this world in a really comedic way, but also like really well executed. And I would contrast that with other things that have tried to be funny in the zombie genre, where no one has really put that level of care into it that I've observed. In terms of how they've shot things, in terms of repeating an arc of stuff to direct you a certain way, to be able to show like how things have changed without having to have like the newscaster like updates and like a general showing up and explaining the situation. Like they have just the briefest of comments from the news anchor about destroying the brain and stuff. But other than that, nobody's really explaining the world to them or the rules, and it's all about them, you know, figuring out that everything's been destroyed. So I think that's way better, way more interesting to watch, and way better shot and composed than in World War Z when the same outbreak happens.
Yeah, I mean, you know, Shaun of the Dead aside, Edgar Wright makes movies that are much, that feel like movies, and he's got a style that is conducive to comedy and action, and it works well together. But yeah, Shaun of the Dead is one of those ones where it has a structure, and it feels like a movie, and it moves along as it should. They discover things as they need them, and they do what they have to do to move the plot along, and, you know, they deal with overcoming obstacles because, you know, they... Sean doesn't, like, lock his family in the upstairs of a safe house and go outside trying to solve the zombie outbreak. He just wants to survive it and be with the people that he cares about, which is, again, what I would suggest a normal human being would do, whether or not they had some sort of UN investigator background or not. But, you know, even if you were to take all the humor out of Shaun of the Dead, it's just a more human story in the way people react to it. And, you know, again, whether it was zombies or whether it was a contagion or whether it was a giant monster outside, you know, it would be a more effective story if people acted more like they act in Shaun of the Dead than they do in World War Z.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and like I was saying, at the start of it, you know, we get that glimpse of his imperfect life at the start, and the people that are important to him and why they're important, largely at the start of the film before things have gone downhill, so that when things go downhill, we can see why his motivation is to do certain things, that it's not sort of like a, like in World War C, it's not just sort of like a random happenstance thing that they all happen to be in the car going to on a family trip or something.
Yeah, in Shaun of the Dead, he has to, you know, people think he's a useless piece of garbage, and he has to step up and, you know, rise to the challenge to protect the people he cares about. And, you know, he isn't 100% successful because he's not, you know, a military badass like Brad Pitt's supposed to be. But in the beginning of World War Z, we're meant to believe that Brad Pitt is this military badass, whether we've seen him do anything or not. So we have this expectation right off the gate that, you know, he's going to just fly all around the world and kick all these zombies' asses, and he's going to save the day. Whereas in Shaun of the Dead, we have no idea what's going to happen because we've been led to believe that he's just useless and works at an electronics store where nobody listens to him.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's kind of easy to see that by the end of the film, he will have become unuseless.
Right, but, you know, it's more human in the way it happens because he doesn't save everyone. He doesn't win the day. The, you know, the military does that kind of in a strange way, or, you know, the government at large. But, you know, he finds a way to protect the things that are important to him. He doesn't go out on a mission to save the entire world because that doesn't matter.
Yeah, and I think it does a really good job of it. My issue, which is the reason why I say that it's a film that you like and not a film that I'm a super huge fan of, is that I love the opening and I like the middle and I hate the pub. I hate the whole final battle showdown inside the Winchester.
Why?
Despise it.
What part?
Because the movie to that point had done a very successful job of walking this line of being a zombie movie that is serious about being a zombie movie and a comedy parody of a zombie movie, which is very serious about its comedy. But then when they get to the Winchester and they're in there and they have their final battle, then it airs more on the serious zombie side and sort of loses much of what made the comedy moments, the parody moments interesting at the start of the film. Like it becomes a survival horror thing there, like through and through, it still has character, but I miss the fact that they didn't follow completely through with them having the parody all the way through that scene. They have it return in full force at the end after the pub scene, once they get out on the street and the military shows up, and like the whole news clip thing, all the stuff at the end in the shed, like that, it's all done really well and it's really funny, that very 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 end part. But the Winchester pub part, like, just too much on the serious side. And when you go that heavy on the serious side, you also can't make any mistakes in judgment, like the fact that they're all standing in a room that's surrounded by glass instead of going upstairs was ridiculous. And then they go downstairs into the cellar, and yeah, well, but it was the owners upstairs, right?
Right.
Yeah. So they're not in there anymore. They came down, so you could go up there and lock the door.
Well, at that point, they were kind of panicking. I mean, I guess I didn't find the tone as inconsistent as you did, especially with, you know, there's the funny parts where he decides to play the slot machine game or whatever, or, you know, when they leave the shells on the bar top, then one of them fires off and actually saves them as they can get down into the cellar. You know, there were comedic moments in the Winchester, but it is the climax of the story, so it is going to get a little bit more intense as they do things. But I don't know, I found that there was still humor in it, you know, with the flipping on the light switches, and, you know, that was kind of a silly way that he reacted to that. And The way the stakes increased.
I mean, and you can't fault anybody that plays Queen, especially, don't stop me now, but the, which is, of course, one of the other many brilliant pairings of what's happening in the movie and the music that Edgar Wright selects, which he does in every project, so good job there.
You know, the beating with the pool cues and that, like, weird kung fu move he does where he swings his legs around to hop up, I thought most of that was pretty consistent with the tone of the comedy action zombie thing that they had going on.
Yeah, but then everything surrounding his mom dying.
Well, they have to get serious for a moment. They have to make you, to bring you into the character story even further.
But see, that's the thing that alienated me, is that they get so serious there and she's definitely going to die and things are going to be really bad. And everybody that we've seen up to this point has died and things have gone really bad. But then at the end of the movie, when we see that he is still BFFs with Nick Frost, like, that he didn't kill Nick Frost, that his mom could have theoretically just been captured, then it's kind of like, well, that's also sending a really weird message about his mom, but it had more to do with him arguing with David, and all that heightened tension that didn't seem to go anywhere other than getting rid of David and getting rid of his girlfriend, that... Because they just argue to the point where he walks up to a window and then the zombies finally figure out it's glass.
yeah, I suppose that was a little bit ham-fisted, but there was some humor in there where Nick Frost was holding the broken bottle to his neck and then handed it off to his girlfriend so she would be even with everyone holding bottles to everyone, and then he got another one and broke it and then pointed it at him again. I thought that was, you know, again, adding humor to the moment. But yeah, they did need to get rid of David and his girlfriend, and, you know, maybe there could have been more attention to that. I don't know, but I didn't take issue with that part so much. And yeah, I mean, shooting his mom because she turned did eventually turn out to be unnecessary because they kind of captured the zombies, but I mean, maybe they didn't know that then, I guess. Or,
well, yeah, they didn't know that. You are of course correct to point that out, but at the same time, they don't shoot Nick Frost. Like, they're like, he's like, oh, I'm fine letting you turn into a zombie. Here, well, have our only weapon.
He hadn't turned into a zombie yet, and he wasn't threatening them. But, you know, like, mm-hmm. right before they shot his mom, she was turned and she was, like, lunging at them, I guess. But
yeah,
I see your point. I guess that there's a little bit of inconsistency there, that he does struggle over killing his mom, but, you know, and just kind of, like, walks it off with Nick.
Yeah, well, but he also walks off his mom's death pretty easily by the time they get outside. Like, he's not really talking about his mom at that point. He's talking about things with his girlfriend, you know?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I guess it being a movie, they resolve that part and they kind of let it go. But, you know, if he were an actual human being, he probably would be mourning over that for a little bit longer, even though his immediate attention would have been required for survival purposes. Yeah, he does kind of go to the girlfriend bit kind of easily, although, you know, he mentions, you know, I'm gonna lose my mom and my girlfriend in one night, and she said, what makes you think I've taken you back, all that stuff. You know, they do address the transition. It's really just a matter of how successful they were in that.
Yeah,
and if it didn't reach you emotionally, I'm sorry. I will watch it a million times more than I will watch World War Z.
But again, I don't want to make it sound like I in any way disparage Shaun of the Dead, like, when compared to World War Z. Like, even I would rather watch that Winchester Pub stuff than watch the whole WHO headquarter thing at the... Oh, God. That's so stupid. Let's just lurk around in these glass disease rooms for a while.
I'm trying to remember. Was there a reason that they didn't want to kill all of the doctors on the B-Wing? other than the fact that they were, like, formerly friends that they thought they could cure? Was that the reason, or did they not want to start killing one because there were enough that they would be overwhelmed?
Overwhelmed. Their concern was that, which I don't know how they knew this, but apparently they knew that if you killed a zombie, then it attracts more zombies.
Right. Well, they'd been doing research, apparently, even though they had come up with nothing.
Yeah. So...
But, I mean, apparently, if these guys were there the entire time, and they have zombies captured, and they've been studying them to try and find a cure, all it took was Brad Pitt watching, what, two separate instances of zombies attack human beings to figure out that they don't attack sick people? Like, How could the World Health Organization not figure that? It's like, why are we even still? I'm not a fan of zombie movies or TV shows, and I enjoy Shaun of the Dead because the characters are quite humorous, and mm-hmm. Edgar Wright is a great director.
Yes.
But, you know, the zombie part I could care less about.
Yeah, well, but, and this is kind of why it's my least favorite of the Cornetto trilogy, with Hot Fuzz being number one and World's End being number two.
Yeah, I mean, but, you know, if we're talking about this whole zombies unnecessary thing, the World's End isn't too dissimilar to Shaun of the Dead in that it's survival at this point, and, you know, they do what they gotta do, but, you know, it doesn't matter what the monster is.
Yeah, no, and I agree with that. It doesn't matter what, it doesn't matter whether it's space alien robots that assume the form of people and then liquidate them for some reason. Doesn't make any sense. But the...
we should talk about that movie another time. I really like The World's End.
Yeah, no, I like it too. But so it has a lot of similarities, especially with, you know, showing that things are not right in the area. And that's also something else they do in Hot Fuzz, is showing that things are not right. And Edgar Wright does a really good job of showing, you know, things that are askew, that things are not where they should be. So I think that it's really well done in all three of those films, and Shaun of the Dead just happens to be my favorite because it is, because of the way it is executed, in a zombie medium where you see an outbreak, which would be very obvious to anyone who is paying attention, but is totally lost on Simon Pegg's character, mm-hmm. which I find hilarious every time I watch,
yeah.
even though it's, you know, awful what has happened to London.
It's a great movie, and it's full of great characters that you want to hang out with regardless of what they're doing.
No, I don't really want to hang out with Nick Frost's character before or after he turns into a zombie.
Fair enough. Oh, man. So you found The Walking Dead?
No. I tried to watch some of it, and I was just like, it's a lot of talking about things,
yeah.
and I don't care about any of the things you're talking about, so yeah. it's hard for me to attach myself. But I mean, it's one of those things where apparently it has gotten better and worse and better and worse and better and worse, and so it's on a bit of a roller coaster. So I'm sure I'll find out eventually from somebody that stays through it whether or not it was worth watching.
Roller coaster aside, the premise is uninteresting in the first place.
Yeah. Well, I'm fine with post-apocalyptic stuff. It's just that I find it more interesting after the post-apocalypse has happened. An ongoing post-apocalypse or a post-apocalypse just happening is not satisfying for me because I'd rather see the resolution to it. It's like watching the beginning of a movie.
Yeah.
And that's kind of how I feel about World War Z. It's like it's watching the beginning of a movie that just goes on forever.
Yeah, the post-apocalypse thing is, you know, like I said, it's a matter of survival, but it's fascinating in that sort of fantasy way that you would think, like, you know, how would you survive? Pretend it's, you know, 500 years ago. Like, how would you survive with all of the modern weapons and housing and, you know, all the modern infrastructure? How would you use that to survive in a world that is as harsh as it was, you know, hundreds and hundreds of years ago? And that's kind of an interesting thought process that leads you down an interesting story. But it's, again, the zombies are a framing device that are completely unnecessary at that point.
Well, they could be good if we're talking about post-zombie apocalypse. Like, if whether or not the zombies are there means nothing to the story happening as it's unfolding. Like, if they're just the force of nature, then that's fine. It's when they're a problem to solve that they often become a problem, because it shouldn't really matter whether or not what the zombies are doing. You know?
Are there any zombie movies where they actually go on to cure the zombies? There's that one with the kid from X-Men who was dead and then comes back with Cordry in it.
Yes, can't remember the name of it.
I can't remember it either. But yeah. You know, like if the zombies are a problem to solve, like how many movies have actually tried to solve them?
Well, but see, most of the time they're trying to solve it. It's not to cure people that are zombies. It's trying to like come up with the thing that will get rid of the zombies. You know, it's not terribly compassionate, but. But yeah, I mean, that's one of those things. It's like with I Am Legend and with which I Am Legend, Jesus Christ, which has a lot in common with World War Z. It's not it's not very well thought out whenever they try to do that, because then you have to be very specific about your zombie rules, and then you have to have a character that is capable of processing things and coming up with the solution like Brad Pitt's character did, and then it becomes sort of annoying because it's like, well, how did they come up with this solution? Like, why does this even make any sense that this is a flaw? Like, yeah. What happens with the zombies if it's a design flaw, if it's like some intentional consequence of how they work, like whether or not they can't see people that are sick, right, or whether they, you know, their heads, if they're removed, cause them to stop functioning. Like, whatever rule they come up with for this stuff, it's like it has to make consistent logical sense. And usually in a movie where it has a beginning and an end where they solve the zombie crisis, then it usually has a very bad solution at the end.
Yeah, most of those movies are a search to build a better mouse trap, or I guess build a better zombie trap, and really most of the time it just comes down to guns and bombs, which is probably what they should have guessed in the first place.
Yeah. Oh yeah, and the sequel to 28 Days Later, I didn't watch it, but apparently they had cured people too.
I watched it, but I couldn't tell you what actually happened. I don't remember.
I think that's a ringing endorsement.
Final thoughts on zombies?
They suck.
Yeah, screw them.